Hello, this is the Talking Information Center. Today we'll be reading from the Wednesday, August 19th, 2026 edition of Reuters News. Trump put thousands of soldiers on Washington's street. They seldom stop crime. By Brad Heath. Well past midnight one day this spring, three police officers pulled up to a nightclub where a man was stomping on a young woman lying on the sidewalk. The officers stopped the attack and arrested him, according to a police report. It was the kind of assault police might encounter on almost any night in almost any city. But one detail stood out to police officer Xavier Jimenez, who wrote the report. There were approximately 15 National Guard members in the area on routine patrol who did not take any action. President Donald Trump deployed thousands of National Guard troops to Washington last summer as the centerpiece of what he describes as a no-holds-barred effort to combat crime, especially in cities run by Democrats. Every day, small clots of soldiers in camouflage and body armor patrol tourist-heavy areas of the U.S. Capitol, including national monuments, subway stations, and the area around its professional baseball park. What the soldiers seldom do, Reuters found, is fight crime. Since their arrival last August, the National Guard soldiers Trump ordered to Washington have been mentioned in only a tiny fraction, about 1.3% of the criminal cases filed in the Superior Court of the District of Columbia, which handles nearly all the city's criminal prosecutions. In dozens of cases, the soldiers appear not as people making the arrests, but as victims of crime. The roughly 4,500 soldiers currently deployed to Washington outnumber its 3,200 police officers, and they cost more. The Trump administration last year told Congress that sending guardsmen to the Capitol cost about $1.65 million a day, before officials doubled the number of troops this summer. The city's most recent police budget was about $1.5 million daily. The administration told Congress it plans to keep sending soldiers to Washington, though it has not said how many, until the end of Trump's presidency in 2029 at a cost of $1.4 billion. To gauge the impact of that deployment, Reuters reviewed every publicly available charging document filed in Superior Court and interviewed lawyers, residents, service members, and others who are familiar with their work. The soldiers mostly responded to minor incidents in neighborhoods that are wealthier, whiter, and less dangerous than the rest of the Capitol. Reuters found after comparing court records to the city's demographics and crime information. Reuters could find no reference in court records to soldiers doing any kind of law enforcement in the neighborhoods where about 82% of the city's 859 murders occurred over the last 5 years. The White House did not respond to questions about soldiers' work. Spokeswoman Lauren Biss said Trump's efforts in the city have driven down crime, beautified the city, and improved quality of life for countless individuals. D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser, who has called the deployment problematic, declined to comment, as did the city's police department. The National Guard Task Force managing the Washington deployment did not respond to questions about its work or its cost. A spokeswoman, Leona Hendrickson, said soldiers were too busy to be interviewed. Although soldiers have sometimes broken up fights or assaults, many of the crimes for which they detained people have been minor. In October, soldiers chased down a man who had taken two slices of pizza and offered $2 as partial payment, according to police records. A week later, they stopped a man who threw a rock at a bus. In April, they detained a man who allegedly stole two beef jerky sticks worth about $7 from a pharmacy, according to the report. Last month, six soldiers held a woman who drank a bottle of root beer without paying. The Reverend William Young, who lives in the Navy Yard neighborhood where soldiers patrol frequently, laughed when asked whether the troops made him feel safer. "It's a way of keeping fear in all of us," he said. "This is not how a capital of a democracy should be protected, by having soldiers marching to protect the streets." They could have done more. Reuters found 217 criminal cases in Washington in which police mentioned the involvement of the National Guard. In about a quarter of them, 62 cases, soldiers single-handedly stopped people suspected of a crime, often for things like shoplifting or jumping turnstiles to avoid paying subway fare. In another 43 cases, soldiers helped police officers arrest someone. Videos obtained by community groups also show troops in groups of 20 or more stationed outside subway stations at night, blocking teens from descending the escalators to enforce a city curfew. It's like they brought people here from all across the country just to be here. And they harass people a lot more than they're actually doing police work, said the Reverend Norman Nixon, the pastor of the Union Temple Baptist Church. Although the guardsmen have been deputized as U.S. Marshals, according to government records, they have limited law enforcement power. The Defense Department has described their work as presence patrols, a show of force meant to deter crime rather than respond to it. They can detain suspects, but then must call police officers to make a formal arrest. Court records describe 35 instances in which the troops were witnesses to crimes, sometimes simply watching until police officers arrived. They have told officers about a drug deal, a man urinating in public, another who exposed himself to a subway policeman, and two men riding with chalk on a monument outside the city's train station, one of them wearing a banana costume. Evelyn Jones said she wonders whether soldiers could have saved her nephew, Keon Jones, who was stabbed to death in April near a trendy strip of hotels and restaurants on the city's waterfront. The soldiers called emergency services after finding Jones unresponsive after a fight. They later told police they thought Jones was merely intoxicated. They did not realize until after officers reached the scene that he had been stabbed so severely his intestines were spilling out. He died in hospital about 2 hours later. They could have done more to help him, his aunt said. The service members themselves have often been victims, a fact underscored last year when two soldiers from West Virginia were shot not far from the White House, killing one of them. Reuters found 62 cases in which people were charged with pushing, punching, or threatening soldiers. 9 were accused of spitting on the soldiers. One man allegedly tried to grab a soldier's pistol as the soldier tried to arrest him for stealing baseball caps in a subway station. Another man was charged after he told a group of soldiers that he wanted to shoot you with a bazooka, according to a police report. And twice, police in Washington arrested off-duty soldiers for violating the city's firearms laws, though the U.S. Attorney's Office dropped the charges against both of them. This summer, they took on a new mission, guarding the Lincoln Memorial Reflecting Pool, which the Trump administration spent millions of dollars to renovate, only to see it turn green with algae as its liner peeled away. Trump claimed the pool was sabotaged by vandals, but U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, Jeanine Perot, eventually conceded that a government contractor botched the job. Patrolling Safer Neighborhoods. The U.S. has long used National Guard soldiers to respond to disasters, help secure major events like the Super Bowl, and occasionally quell riots, but they haven't been used for everyday crime fighting. Trump also authorized smaller deployments in Memphis and New Orleans and has mused about sending soldiers to other cities. You do not want armed soldiers on the streets of America, said General Randy Manner, who retired in 2012 as the second in command of the National Guard Bureau. He said soldiers are ill-prepared for police work and more expensive than hiring more police officers. Determining the soldiers' impact on crime in Washington is not straightforward. In addition to the soldiers, the Trump administration sent hundreds of extra federal agents into the city, who largely functioned as local police officers. The number of murders in Washington fell for the third consecutive year, but homicide numbers also dropped in cities where the government has not sent soldiers or additional federal agents, and the total number of violent crimes, serious assaults, robberies, and sex offenses, in addition to homicides, reported by city police between January and mid-August is marginally higher than last year, by about 4%. A study in May by the nonpartisan Niskanen Center found that sending soldiers into Washington led to fewer stolen cars, but had no impact on violent crimes. Charles Stimson, a senior fellow at the pro-Trump Heritage Foundation, said the soldiers' visibility served as a deterrent. When you're speeding and you see a cop, you slow down, he said. If those National Guard went poof and left town tomorrow, crime would go up. The Reuters review of court records found little evidence of soldiers' presence in high-crime neighborhoods where they might have responded to more serious crimes. Instead, the court records show soldiers were more likely to be mentioned in arrest records in city neighborhoods that have higher incomes, in which more people have college degrees, and where more people are white. Most of the arrests in which soldiers participated were either near the city's core or its subway stops. Reuters used the location of incidents in court records to identify the areas in which soldiers were either assisting the police or seeking help from them, then compared those neighborhoods to the rest of the city. That does not account for places soldiers might have been sent if they did not interact with law enforcement there, but it suggests that their presence was not aimed at quelling the violent crime that has ravaged part of the city in the past. Salim Adafo, an outreach coordinator with the Anacostia Coordinating Council, a nonprofit operating in a low-income part of the city, said that matched his experience. "I haven't seen them all year," he said. Most Americans believe Trump has inappropriately profited since returning to power, Reuters Ipsos poll finds, by Jason Lange and Bo Erickson. A majority of Americans believe President Donald Trump and his family have inappropriately profited from cryptocurrency since his return to power, and that his policy decisions are influenced by his private business dealings, a new Reuters Ipsos poll found. The four-day poll completed on Monday found that half of Trump's own Republicans believe the president allows considerations for his business interests to influence his decisions, a striking finding for a leader who pledged to clean up corruption in Washington. Trump was born into a New York real estate family and built his name into a globally recognized brand before running for office. He earned more than $1.4 billion last year from his family's cryptocurrency ventures, including World Liberty Financial and the Trump meme coin, digital assets he has publicly championed. In March 2025, 2 months into his second term, the president called attention on social media to his self-branded crypto coin, describing it as the greatest of them all. Some 63% of respondents said it was inappropriate for Trump and his family to have profited in that way, while 32% said it was appropriate and the rest did not answer the question. About 3 in 10 Republican respondents called the deals inappropriate, while 7 in 10 said they were appropriate. Democrats regularly highlight alleged corruption in the administration ahead of the November midterm elections that will determine control of Congress for the next 2 years. While Trump's administration has vowed to investigate alleged corruption in Democratic-run states, Trump says he has no day-to-day role in his family's business since returning to office and that his investments are independently managed. He has pursued crypto-friendly policies in his second term after courting crypto cash on the campaign trail. The White House dismissed any allegations of impropriety, saying Trump's investments were managed by independent financial institutions. "There are no conflicts of interest," White House spokeswoman Anna Kelly said in a statement. "The president only acts in the best interest of the American public." Nothing like this before. But experts on presidential ethics call the current confluence of business and politics in the White House unprecedented. "We have seen nothing like this before. Even the first Trump administration did not have as many complex business interests as the second Trump administration," said Richard Painter, the top ethics lawyer for Republican President George W. Bush. Some 69% of Americans, including two-thirds of independents and 9 in 10 Democrats, said they thought Trump's private business interests were influencing his presidential decisions. Americans are divided on whether the corruption is worse under the Trump administration than under other recent presidents. Democrats largely think there's more graft, while Republicans are split roughly down the middle, with 56% thinking corruption is at least a little better, and the rest thinking it is steady or worse. It's concerning, said Thomas Schmidt, a semi-retired crossing guard in Cudahy, Wisconsin, who voted for Trump in 2024, but has soured on the president this year. He should be more concerned with his presidency than with his business practices. Schmidt said his biggest worries are about Trump's inability to control inflation or extract the U.S. from the war with Iran that he helped start. He doesn't think Trump is different from other presidents in mixing his business deals with politics. I think every president's done something like that. Trump campaigned ahead of his 2016 presidential victory on a promise to fight corruption in Washington, or drain the swamp, as he put it. The public's views of Trump's personal enrichment could weigh on his party in the November midterm elections, which will determine who controls Congress during the last 2 years of his term. Americans say corruption is prevalent across all levels of government, with 4 in 10 Democrats saying they're extremely angry about graft, compared with 1 in 4 Republicans. When poll respondents were asked which party was more corrupt, 41% pointed to the Democratic Party and 49% to the Republican Party. The Reuters Ipsos poll, which was conducted online, surveyed 1,166 U.S. adults nationwide between August 14th and August 17th. The results had a margin of error of 3 percentage points for all Americans and 5 points for Democrats, Republicans, and Independents. Former Fauci advisor pleads guilty in U.S. to conspiring to conceal COVID-19 records. By Nate Raymond. A former advisor to infectious disease expert Anthony Fauci pleaded guilty on Tuesday to conspiring to evade public records laws and conceal government documents related to grant research funding and the COVID-19 pandemic. David Morins, who had worked under Fauci as a senior official at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases during the pandemic, entered his plea to a conspiracy charge during a hearing in federal court in Greenbelt, Maryland. The 78-year-old had been indicted in April on charges related to what prosecutors said was a scheme to thwart public records requests received by the agency beginning in April 2020 related to COVID-19 research grants. He faces up to 5 years in prison when he's sentenced on November 12th. By pleading guilty today, Dr. Morins has taken responsibility for what he did, and he will continue to do so. Timothy Belovitz, his lawyer, said in a statement, the plea came after Fauci, who led the NIAID for 38 years and became the face of the U.S. pandemic response, appeared before a Senate panel last month and repeatedly invoked his right against self-incrimination as he accused Republican Senator Paul Rand, a longtime adversary from Kentucky, of pursuing an unhinged campaign to see him imprisoned. COVID's origins remain unresolved. The FBI said in 2023 that a leak from a Wuhan laboratory likely caused the pandemic, a claim that China said had no credibility whatsoever. The CIA said in January 2025 a lab leak was likely, but with low confidence, while 4 other U.S. intelligence agencies and the National Intelligence Council believe the virus most likely emerged via natural transmission from some animal. Prosecutors said that Morin's plea related to the National Institute of Health's decision to cancel a research grant related to bat coronavirus based on allegations that COVID-19 emerged from the Wuhan lab. The China-based lab had received a sub-award from the company that had received the grant. Prosecutors said that Morins pledged to help restore the bat coronavirus grant and counter the narrative COVID-19 leaked from a lab. Anticipating their communications would be sought through Freedom of Information Act requests, Morins and others agreed to correspond using Morins' personal email account instead of his government one, prosecutors said. 5 takeaways from Tuesday's primaries in Florida and Alaska by Richard Cowan and Andy Sullivan. A centrist Democrat advanced in Alaska, bolstering the party's hopes of winning control of the Senate in the November elections that will determine control of Congress, while a left-wing candidate scored an upset victory in Florida, the latest chapter in an insurgency that is roiling the party. Meanwhile, candidates endorsed by President Donald Trump had mixed results. Here are some takeaways from Tuesday's primary elections. Upset in Florida hurts odds for Democrats in the Senate race. Alex Vindman, a national security expert who was thrust into the spotlight when he testified during Trump's first impeachment, raised over $16 million in his bid to win the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate. But he lost to Democratic Socialist Angie Nixon, who raised less than $1 million. That will likely lengthen the odds for a Democratic victory in November against incumbent Republican Senator Ashley Moody. Nonpartisan analysts said Vindman stood a better chance of appealing to more centrist voters whose support would be crucial in a state where there are 1.5 million more registered Republicans than Democrats. Democrats need to pick up 4 seats from Republicans to win control of the 100-seat Senate. Florida was already a reach for Democrats. Now it's likely beyond their grasp. Nixon's upset victory was the latest in a string of Democratic primary wins by progressive candidates who have capitalized on frustrations with party leadership that many voters see as too old and ineffective in opposing the Republican president. But other Florida progressives did not fare as well as Nixon. Oliver Larkin, who was backed by the Democratic Socialists of America, lost a primary challenge to centrist Democratic Representative Jared Moskowitz in Florida's 25th Congressional District, while progressive challenger Elijah Manley came in third place in the nearby 20th Congressional District. Republicans cement their dominance in Florida. Florida used to be one of the most hotly contested battleground states, but that has become increasingly Republican in recent years. Tuesday's returns offered further evidence, with Republican candidates drawing roughly 1.6 million votes in the statewide U.S. Senate and governor contests, compared to 1.2 million votes for the Democratic candidates. It also was the first election conducted under a new congressional map pushed through this spring by the Republican state legislature, which could yield 4 more seats for Republicans in the U.S. House of Representatives in November. That would leave the state with a House delegation of 24 Republicans and only 4 Democrats. Along with the U.S. Senate race, nonpartisan analysts say Republicans are likely to win the governor's race as well. Republican Byron Donalds would be the state's first black governor if he defeats Democrat David Jolly. Democrats see a northern light in Alaska. In Alaska, by contrast, centrist Democrat Mary Peltola posted a strong result in the state's nonpartisan primary for U.S. Senate, drawing more votes than incumbent Republican Senator Dan S. Sullivan. The two will face off in November in what Democrats see as one of their best pickup opportunities. Alaska has not had a Democratic senator since 2014. With 93% of precincts reporting, Peltola was taking 48% of the vote compared with 42.8% for Sullivan. Still unresolved whether another Republican candidate with a similar name, Dan J. Sullivan, would also make the cut as one of the top 4 candidates to advance to the November general election. The former school teacher was in third place with 2.4% of the vote. Dan J. Sullivan's candidacy has alarmed Republicans, who accuse him of entering the race in an attempt to confuse voters and draw votes from Dan S. Sullivan. The U.S. Justice Department is investigating, according to a source familiar with the matter. Dan J. Sullivan has said he entered the race because he was frustrated with the incumbent, but does not aim to mislead voters. Floridians vote by mail, defying Trump. Trump has long cast doubt on the security of mail ballots and has amplified baseless assertions that they have resulted in widespread fraud. He's vowed to end the use of mail-in ballots before the midterms, so far without success. Many Florida voters don't seem to share his concerns. Some 1.15 million cast their ballots by mail in Tuesday's primaries, according to state figures, compared with 818,000 who voted early in person and 1.3 million who voted in person on Tuesday. Among those who voted by mail, Trump himself, according to media reports. The White House said that was not inconsistent with his drive to limit the practice, as they said he would allow exemptions for those like himself who could not vote in person. As everyone knows, the president is a resident of Palm Beach and participates in Florida elections, but he obviously primarily lives at the White House in Washington, D.C., White House spokeswoman Olivia Wales said. Trump's mixed record on endorsements. Trump has shaped the Republican Party and his image in recent years by endorsing candidates in primary races. He posted a mixed record on Tuesday. His early endorsement of Donald's helped clear the field in the race to succeed Republican Governor Ron DeSantis, who has occasionally clashed with Trump. Trump also picked a winner in an open congressional seat as Sidney Gruters, the wife of Republican National Committee Chair Joe Gruters, won the Republican nomination in a Tampa Bay area district. But entrepreneur Catalina Loeff failed to win the Republican nomination in a crowded contest for Donald's seat, despite Trump's backing. Loeff served in Trump's administration during his first 2017 through 2021 White House term. Trump's endorsement likewise failed to help Representative Corey Mills, who lost the Republican nomination to former TV anchor Ryan Elijah. Mills faces a House Ethics Committee investigation for alleged sexual misconduct and campaign finance violations, which he denies. Trump endorsed Elijah on Wednesday. "I told Congressman Corey Mills of Florida, a friend of mine, to get out of the race, but he wouldn't listen," he wrote on his Truth Social platform. "We now have a great candidate, Ryan Elijah, running in his place." In Wyoming, Trump backed Representative Harriet Hageman, easily won the Republican nomination for Senate. Trump undertakes sweeping makeover of the White House and Washington, by Steve Holland and Trevor Honeycutt. U.S. President Donald Trump is pursuing an ambitious remaking of Washington, with plans for projects ranging from a new White House ballroom, which he calls a national security priority, to a 250-foot arch and a recast Kennedy Center. Like Theodore Roosevelt's overhaul of the National Mall in the early 1900s and Harry Truman's reconstruction of the White House in the early 1950s, Trump's building projects represent a major presidential imprint on Washington. Unlike those efforts, however, Trump's plans have sparked criticism from Americans concerned about the preservation of historic landmarks. Here are some of Trump's projects. The Reflecting Pool. Trump announced in April that he was remodeling Washington's historic Lincoln Memorial Reflecting Pool near the site where Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his 1963 I Have a Dream speech. A more than $16 million renovation project followed on the 2,000-foot pool, carried out by contractors who were not selected through a competitive bidding process. Trump declared the renovation project complete on June 6, but the pool was soon found to have peeling paint and algae growth that turned its crystal blue waters green. Trump and other administration officials blamed the damage on vandals without citing evidence, and authorities arrested a former U.S. Olympic canoeist whom they charged with vandalizing the pool. The former Olympian denied the charges, and the Department of Justice drew criticism from Trump when it dropped the charges. U.S. Attorney Jeanine Pirro and Assistant U.S. Attorney Michael Spence, in a court filing, blamed a rushed and flawed installation process. The White House Ballroom. Trump says the planned 90,000-square-foot ballroom will be the greatest of its kind ever built. He initially said he and wealthy donors would pay for the estimated $400 million project, but he later unsuccessfully sought $1 billion from Congress for an underground bunker and security features to harden the ballroom. An appeals court ruled on August 7th that the construction had to stop because Trump had launched the project without congressional approval. Trump has since appealed that ruling to the U.S. Supreme Court. Trump says the new structure will include bomb shelters, medical facilities, defenses against drones and missiles, and other security features. The ballroom, which Trump has said will seat 1,000 guests, has faced public backlash. Preservationists and opponents say Trump exceeded his authority when he demolished the historic East Wing, which housed the First Lady's offices and the White House movie theater, to make room for this structure. The Kennedy Center. Congress created the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts to honor the Democratic president who was assassinated in 1963. Since taking office in 2025, Trump has purged the center's leadership, changed its programming, and appointed a board that added his name to the edifice. A U.S. District Court judge ordered in May, however, that his name be removed. The Kennedy Center board, controlled by Trump appointees, subsequently voted on August 13th to put Trump's name back on the building, calling it the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, restored and renovated by President Donald J. Trump. This has set up a potential clash with the judge. The Oval Office. Trump has transformed the historic room with gold accents and statuettes, portraits of famous Americans pulled from storage, including some who are not easily identifiable, and a copy of the Declaration of Independence that hangs on the wall. Busts of Abraham Lincoln and Benjamin Franklin are now situated on tables near his desk. The Rose Garden and the White House grounds. Outside the Oval Office, Trump replaced the Rose Garden's grass lawn with a white stone patio and umbrella-covered tables, giving it a patio style similar to Trump's Mar-a-Lago Club in Palm Beach, Florida. Trump also added statues of U.S. independence heroes Alexander Hamilton and Benjamin Franklin in the Rose Garden, along with a sculpture called Freedom's Charge that depicts two Revolutionary War soldiers. Trump ripped out the flagstone walkway that had lined the West Wing colonnade adjacent to the Rose Garden for 60 years and replaced it with a black granite surface. Along the colonnade wall, he placed portraits of America's past presidents, with a plaque beneath each inscribed with Trump's view of that person. Trump did not include a portrait of Joe Biden, who defeated him in the 2020 election. Triumphal Arch. Across the Potomac River from the Lincoln Memorial lies a highway roundabout near the entrance to Arlington National Cemetery, where Trump wants to build a triumphal arch. The arch would be reminiscent of the Arc de Triomphe in Paris, but much bigger. The height of the arch, with eagle statues and a Lady Liberty-type figure on top, would be around 250 feet. That is taller than the Lincoln Memorial and close to the height of the U.S. Capitol, which at 288 feet can be seen across much of Washington. Whether the arch may ultimately be built at that height remains unclear, as it is close to the flight path of southbound planes on the final approach to Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport, a few miles away. Garden of American Heroes. Trump has talked about establishing a national Garden of American Heroes since his first term in office in 2017. Congress in 2025 provided $40 million for the project, which Trump plans to develop at West Potomac Park along the Potomac River to mark the 250th anniversary of U.S. independence. Trump said the park will include statues of the country's founding fathers, members of the military, religious leaders, civil rights champions, athletes, artists, and entertainers. The project's opening has been delayed from the initial target date of July 4th. Preservation groups have sued to have the project halted on legal grounds. East Potomac Golf Links. The president has said he wants to begin work on September 1st to overhaul Washington's East Potomac Golf Links, a century-old public golf course. Trump, a frequent golfer who owns several courses, has said he hopes the renovation will allow the course to host major tournaments. That project is also tied up in legal challenges by groups that say it violates the law. Marine One Helipad. Trump has ordered that a helipad be built on the White House south lawn to protect the grass from the scorching exhaust of his latest Marine One helicopter. He ordered contractors back to the drawing board after weeks of work on the project because of a slope in the south lawn under the helipad, the Washington Post reported. Wall Street up after tech sell-off as yields retreat. Moderna surges. By Avinash P. and Purvi Agarwal. The main U.S. stock indices recovered on Wednesday after a technology-driven slump in the previous session as government bond yields retreated from multi-decade highs and investors assessed a slew of corporate updates. Vaccine maker Moderna's shares more than doubled after its personalized mRNA cancer therapy developed with Merck cut the risk of melanoma recurrence and spread in late-stage trial. Merck jumped 9.6%, lifting the blue-chip Dow. Biotech peers also gained. Novavax was up 6.8%, while U.S.-listed shares of BioNTech rallied 17.5%. The S&P 500 healthcare sector rose 2.7% to hit a record high and was the biggest gainer on the benchmark index. Marvel Technologies surged about 9% after the chipmaker issued Alphabet's Google a warrant to buy a stake worth about $12.18 billion. Broadcom declined more than 4% after the deal, weighing on the Philadelphia SE Semiconductor Index. Tech stocks on the benchmark S&P 500 declined 0.4%, limiting market gains. Heavyweight tech stocks came under sharp selling pressure on Tuesday as government yields hit multi-decade highs on concerns over ballooning government debt and geopolitics that battered the bond market. The yield on the 30-year Treasury bond retreated from its highest level since 2007 after the U.S. Treasury announced it would double the size of liquidity support buyback operations for longer-dated bonds, boosting risk appetite. It was last at 5.209%. Most tech companies are priced mainly on forward earnings expectations, and when interest rates creep up, those expectations are worth less and the stocks are worth less, said Robert Pavlik, senior portfolio manager at Dakota Wealth. At 9:36 a.m. Eastern Time, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 119.94 points to 53,463, spot 34. The S&P 500 gained 28.48 points to 7,720, spot 24. And the NASDAQ Composite was up 67.17 points to 26,356, spot 89. Investors also scrutinized quarterly earnings from retailers for insight into the health of the U.S. consumer. Target was up 3.3% after raising its annual sales forecast, while Lowe's gained 1.8% despite trimming its annual sales growth forecast. Estee Lauder jumped more than 14% after the cosmetics maker forecast annual profit above Wall Street estimates. Retail bellwether Walmart is due to report quarterly earnings on Thursday. Meanwhile, U.S. President Donald Trump said no talks were taking place with Iran and insisted the Strait of Hormuz was open, contradicting Iran's assertion that the strait remained shut to shipping. Brent crude futures added 0.2% to hit near three-week highs. Minutes from the U.S. Federal Reserve July meeting later in the day will be parsed for a clearer picture of the central bank's policy outlook. Traders currently see at least one 25 basis point rate hike from the Fed by the end of 2026, according to data compiled by LSEG. The odds of a hike as soon as September, however, have decreased significantly following last week's tame inflation data. Robust earnings from several sectors, including some AI hyperscalers, lifted the S&P 500 and the Dow to record highs earlier this month, but doubts lingered about whether hefty AI spending can yield tangible results soon. Advancing issues outnumbered decliners by a 3.97-to-1 ratio on the New York Stock Exchange and by a 2.35-to-1 ratio on the NASDAQ. The S&P 500 posted 8 new 52-week highs and no new lows, while the NASDAQ Composite recorded 60 new highs and 29 new lows. Trump pauses tariffs on Canadian imports. Carney says key work remains. By Kanishka Singh, Pramit Mukherjee, and Maria Chang. U.S. President Donald Trump announced late on Tuesday he was putting a three-day pause on new 50% tariffs set to go into effect on Canadian goods at midnight, saying the two countries had reached a deal. An hour later, Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney said in a statement that substantial progress has been made, although there is important work still to be done. Trump said in his post on Truth Social that he paused the tariffs based on the fact that Canada and the USA, subject to the finalization of documents, have a deal. Trump and Carney spoke on Tuesday afternoon, their second conversation this week, and their negotiators have been involved in weeks of intense, opaque talks. While we continue this work, Canada remains focused on building a stronger, more independent, and more competitive economy at home, Carney said in his statement. U.S. Trade Representative Jameson Greer's office said the deal will include comprehensive market access for all American goods, economic security commitments, and digital trade alignments, and other provisions. In a proclamation posted on the White House website, Trump said he had received Canada's commitment to address U.S. concerns related to duties on dairy products, alcoholic beverages, and motor vehicles. U.S. officials provided no further details, and the Canadian government did not confirm any contents of an agreement. Existing U.S. auto tariffs had been a sticking point, two industry sources familiar with the talks said earlier. The new U.S. tariffs would have covered about $20 billion worth of imports and applied regardless of whether Canadian goods qualify for preferential treatment under the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, which has shielded much of Canadian industry from earlier U.S. tariffs. Trump added in his social media post that the Keystone XL pipeline, a project canceled by former President Joe Biden in 2021 after years of indigenous and environmental opposition, may be awoken from the grave, but did not provide details. Trump has made tariffs a central pillar of his foreign and trade policies, despite legal setbacks and criticism from some analysts. Tariffs could have led to job losses and business closures. Trade experts and industry officials said earlier that the new tariffs could lead to job losses and business closures in vulnerable sectors in Canada, including lumber, wine, and dairy. They also warned the dispute could complicate broader USMCA negotiations. Canada's minister responsible for U.S. trade, Dominic LeBlanc, and chief trade negotiator Janice Charette have been in Washington since last week for talks. On Monday, the Canadian officials met for nearly 2 hours with Greer and Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick. Greer has repeatedly cited Canada's tariffs that followed initial U.S. tariffs, the Canadian Dairy Supply Management System, and some provinces' refusal to stock U.S. liquor, among other U.S. grievances. In a statement late on Tuesday, the Distilled Spirits Council of the U.S. applauded Trump's announcement and called for a negotiated solution that gets American spirits back on retail shelves in all Canadian provinces and returns the spirits sector to a zero-for-zero tariff framework. The sides have also discussed cutting U.S. Section 232 tariffs on Canadian vehicles to 15% from 25%, with further reductions based on the amount of U.S. content in each vehicle, the sources had said. Counting tariff deductions. A major point of contention was how tariff deductions based on content should be calculated, with Washington demanding that only U.S.-produced content be counted. Canada pushed for all North American content, including Canadian and Mexican parts, to be counted, sources had said earlier. Earlier on Tuesday, the U.S. Commerce Department released new rules for automakers exporting from Canada and Mexico to certify their current levels of U.S. content for tariff deductions, reducing the complicated exercise to once per year from twice. But the Federal Register notice said automakers must recertify vehicles' American content by September 30th for them to claim deductions in the new annual cycle that starts on December 1st. A Canadian government source said last week that all options remained on the table if the new tariffs take effect, including government support for affected domestic industries and a possible suspension of bilateral trade talks. But the source expressed hope that the U.S. was keen to reach a deal. U.S. Treasury to double sizes of some debt buyback operations to at least $4 billion, by David Lauder. The U.S. Treasury on Wednesday announced a doubling of buyback sizes for 10 to 30-year Treasury debt securities to at least $4 billion per operation, staunching at least temporarily a weeks-long upward march in yields that had unnerved global investors. The increase from previously planned $2 billion buybacks will apply to the 20-year to 20-year, the 10-year to 20-year sector and the 20-year to 30-year sector and will be effective September 9th through November 4th, the department said in a statement. The move was announced a day after a major bond sell-off pushed the 30-year Treasury yield to its highest level since 2007, amid worries of an imminent escalation in the U.S.-Israeli war with Iran and rising concerns over a deteriorating U.S. fiscal picture as total public debt outstanding nears the $40 trillion mark. Yields had risen on Tuesday despite a previously scheduled $2 billion buyback operation of 20-year and 30-year bonds that day. The 30-year yields had hit a 19-year high of 5.34% on Tuesday, but later subsided, and the Treasury's announcement drove them down further to as low as 5.187%, marking the largest daily drop in yields since late June. The increase in buyback operation sizes reflects Treasury's desire to provide greater liquidity support in longer-dated nominal sectors where there's consistent strong sponsorship from market participants, as evidenced by the significant volume of high-quality offers Treasury routinely receives in longer-dated buyback operations, the Treasury said in a statement. Higher yields, higher costs. Market analysts said Treasury's action reflects sensitivity to debt market pressures potentially becoming more problematic, adding to borrowing costs, keeping mortgage rates high, and risking broader financial market dislocations. I think they fear the pain of 5% or higher yields on the long end, not only because it raises the interest rate costs for the government, but also for the private sector, said Renee Albrecht, senior analyst at DZ Bank in Germany. It's only 3 months until the midterm elections. The yield on the benchmark 10-year Treasury note also was lower on Wednesday, down 6 basis points to 4.65%. They've had to grab into the toolkit in order to get a hand on this recent rise in yields, Albrecht added. The increase was the second time this month that U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has stepped in to try to counteract market moves, having joined Japan in an August 1st currency market intervention aimed at reversing the yen's slide to recent 40-year lows against the U.S. dollar. Bessent is again showing his tactical skill as an activist Treasury Secretary, hitting bond shorts with a surprise announcement of an increased buyback program on an August day with thin liquidity and a lull in prior one-way bets on yields higher. Evercore ISI analysts said in a note to clients that also questioned whether the operation would have a lasting impact. The operation changes almost nothing in terms of the fundamentals, in particular the unchanged need to finance the tidal wave of hyperscaler debt, in addition to very large government deficits. The increased size of the operation is modest relative to the flows in the Treasury market, Evercore ISI said. The $2 billion increase is a pittance compared to the $32.2 trillion Treasury debt market as of Monday, and about $5.5 trillion in outstanding 20-year and 30-year bonds as of July 31st. There was $16.2 trillion of unmatured Treasury notes, which are issued at terms ranging from 2 to 10 years. Overall public debt, including intergovernmental holdings, stood at $39.99 trillion on Monday, and is set to imminently breach the symbolic $40 trillion mark. Buyback schedule adjustments. The Treasury has for the last 2 years engaged in scheduled purchases of older vintage securities prior to their maturity dates to provide liquidity support for those so-called off-the-run bills, notes, and bonds. The next currently scheduled buyback operation for 20- and 30-year bonds is set for September 24th, with a 10- to 20-year buyback scheduled on September 10th. The Treasury said it would publish an updated tentative buyback schedule at a later date. Tuesday's buyback of 20- to 30-year bonds included purchases of $1 billion of a bond maturing in 2048 and another $1 billion of two bonds maturing in 2051, Treasury records show. Investors had offered nearly $20 billion of bonds to Treasury to repurchase in the Tuesday operation, which was the smallest amount investors have sought to sell back so far this year across 11 operations covering that maturity sector. In its quarterly refunding announcement earlier this month, Treasury said it would repurchase up to $69 billion of Treasuries across all maturities between August 6th and November 5th. Three more buybacks of 20- to 30-year bonds and four of 10- to 20-year securities are scheduled in that window, adding at least another $14 billion of liquidity support and bringing the maximum repurchases to $83 billion. Commentary by Mike Dolan. Bonds out, robots in. The bond storm quieted a bit overnight, but left equity markets bruised with an uneasy calm hanging over markets as the U.S. Treasury prepares to sell 20-year debt later on Wednesday. Attention will also turn to the minutes of the Federal Reserve split meeting in July, which could help resolve some of the uncertainty around the central bank's views on persistently elevated inflation. U.S. yields remain near multi-decade highs, but they got some relief following the release of a below-forecast U.S. industrial production report on Tuesday. Still, discussion continues to swirl about what exactly has been driving this latest blowout in borrowing costs, especially given that markets now anticipate less Fed policy tightening than they did only a few weeks ago. Analysts reckon inflation concerns are only part of the problem, as long-term inflation expectations remain contained. They point instead to the so-called term premium on long bonds being demanded by investors to compensate for the uncertainties surrounding borrowing costs and debt sustainability over the horizon. The premium is near its highest level in a decade. Meanwhile, there was little relief on the energy front heading into Wednesday, with crude oil prices still pumped up after the latest negative turn in the Iran conflict this week. The real pressure is building not in crude, however, but in the markets for refined products, such as diesel and home heating. With global refining capacity under strain, the so-called crack spread between crude futures and diesel futures has climbed to a record high this week. This suggests that households and businesses could face higher fuel costs moving into winter. Elsewhere, there was some cheer in U.S.-Canada trade relations as President Donald Trump paused a planned 50% tariff increase on a range of Canadian goods for at least 3 days, as both sides signaled progress in talks. The tariffs were due to hit this week. In China, meantime, the AI stock market frenzy intensified as humanoid robot maker Unitree surged about 600% on its market debut, with retail investors flocking to the IPO. Unitree, which competes with Hyundai Motor Group-owned Boston Dynamics and Tesla, has drawn global attention for its robots that run, dance, and perform martial arts. The stock surged 600% at one point after its debut on the tech-focused Star Market, valuing the company at around $50 billion. The startup has backing from some of China's most influential tech firms, including Tencent, Alibaba, and DeepSeek. At least a half a dozen other Chinese humanoid robotics firms are preparing to go public. Trump says he plans to meet with North Korea's Kim Jong-un. By Steve Holland. U.S. President Donald Trump said Wednesday that he planned to meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and said the Asian nation held 57 very powerful nuclear weapons. The remarks come as Trump ordered Pentagon officials to cut short joint exercises with the South Korean military, writing in a Sunday social media post that they sent a message to Pyongyang that was totally inappropriate and hostile to a country that, as long as Donald J. Trump has been president, has been unthreatening and respectful. During Trump's first term, Kim called Trump a mentally deranged U.S. dotard and threatened that he had use of a nuclear button on his desk. The leader's relationship cooled after face-to-face meetings in 2018 and 19, including a brief exchange at the demilitarized zone between the Koreas, in which Trump became the first U.S. president to step into North Korean territory. I know Kim Jong-un very well, and he's going to be fine as long as we have a smart president, Trump told reporters Wednesday during a tour of the helipad he's constructing on the White House's historic South Lawn. The fact that I get along with him, that's a good thing, not a bad thing. He has 57 very powerful nuclear weapons, Trump said. They should have never allowed it. If I were president, I wouldn't have allowed it, but he's got them. There have been varying estimates by experts over the years on how many nuclear weapons North Korea truly has. In June, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute estimated that North Korea has possibly assembled around 60 warheads, possesses enough fissile material to produce at least 30 more. Trump to host crypto executives as SEC considers regulations. President Donald Trump will host cryptocurrency executives at the White House on Wednesday, as U.S. financial regulators this week prepare to advance their framework for certain digital assets. Trump, who has earned more than $1.4 billion from his family's crypto ventures, is scheduled to make remarks with technology leaders at the White House in the afternoon. Representatives for the White House did not immediately return a request for comment. The Republican president has pursued crypto-friendly policies since returning to office in January 2025, particularly through the SEC and the CFTC. Sweeping crypto legislation, the industry's top priority, has stalled in Congress with little time remaining for lawmakers to approve any bills before the end of the year.